Today's program is brought to you by Cane Vineyard and Winery, a Napa Valley winery committed to respecting the soil and dedicated to the creation of three Cabernet blends. For more information, visit cane5.com.
This is Chef Emily Peterson, host of Sharp and Hot. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to the Grape Nation, your weekly wine journey. Broadcasting deep inside of Roberta's Pizza in Bushwick, Brooklyn on the Heritage Radio Network. We have a great show today. What wines to drink with pizza and other foods. We're going to talk to our own Hugh Crickmore, wine director of Blanca and Roberta's Pizza right here in Bushwick, Brooklyn. Later in the show, we'll taste a Dolcetto d'Alba on our weekly wine sip. I'm your host, Sam Ben Ruby. Stay with us for the Grape Nation. We bring wine to the people. All right, pizza. Pizza has to be one of the most popular foods of all time. Everyone loves and eats pizza, except, of course, me, because I've been gluten-free for the last 2 years. My loss. But that's another story for another day. The pizza bar definitely has been raised in New York City and around the country. Nowadays, you got a lot of different kinds of pizzas to choose from. You got clam pies, white pizza, spicy pies, salad pizzas, and all kinds of meats thrown on top. And all of those have crazy kinds of names, hard to keep track of. Wine actually is a great complement to pizza. And each pizza begs a different wine. Whether you're bringing a pizza home, whether you're going to a restaurant, you're heading to a party, we'll tell you what wines to drink with those pizzas. And I think our guest today can help us with that. Our in-studio guest is Hugh Crickmore, wine director of Blanca and Roberta's Pizza. Hugh is literally a rock star. In all aspects of the word, in wine, in music, in art, and food. I want Hugh to tell you a little about himself. Hugh, welcome to the Grape Nation. Now, I want you to tell my listeners a little about you, because I feel you have a very interesting, colorful background. But the show is less than an hour, so we don't have to start with working on a farm in northern Maine. But you're a New Yorker, and I want everyone to get a taste of all of that. So fill us in.
Well, thanks for having me. I'm a native New Yorker. I was born here, 109th Street on the Upper West Side. I did grow up in Westchester, went to school in New York, in New York City. Been working in restaurants since I was 15 years old.
Why at 15? I mean, was there an influence? Was there a family thing?
That was just something that you did when you were in high school. It was just a way of earning extra money. There was a restaurant that was on the waterfront that a lot of my friends worked at, and it was actually a really positive experience.
Did you start as a busboy?
I started as a dishwasher.
Dishwasher?
Yeah.
All right, keep going. So you got into the business young at 15.
And I never really saw it as something that was going to become a career. And it has been a career on and off, and something that's been very good to me in a lot of ways. But my real interest in wine and food was really when I went to Paris in the late 1990s and was living with a girlfriend, had no
Why
money.
Did you go to Paris?
Really, I was chasing a girl.
Okay, so she got you over there.
Absolutely.
Props to her, because that worked out in a way.
Yeah, and I ended up staying on after she left, and my brother was there. I went to Prague, and I ran a small French restaurant. It was just serendipitous. I was sitting with a bunch of friends in a cafe, and I needed a job, and someone told me that they were looking for a cook in a small restaurant. The owner was French. He was from Paris. I had just come back, and I really went and talked the talk, said I was from New York, that I had restaurant experience, a cooking experience. And
how deep was your cooking experience at that point?
It was not deep at all. But I think that I talked the talk well enough that he was convinced enough to give me a chance, and we ended up to be really good friends. And
so you literally worked trial by fire.
Absolutely. Yeah. It was a simple menu. It wasn't anything difficult. It was pastas and sandwiches, and but it was really fun, and I met some really wonderful people. And I did meet a friend named Nigel, who was a flying winemaker who was in Prague basically to help with a couple of wineries modernize and clean up their act in some ways. And I had read every wine book that I had in Paris that was left over in this apartment. It was all I
Why
had
Why did
to do.
That happen? Just being in Paris?
And it was like we didn't have very much money. Wine. Paris is a fun place to be with little money, but it's actually a place... if you're in New York and don't have any money, you drink beer. If you're in Paris and have no money, you're drinking wine.
So you educated yourself.
Exactly. And it was still just a neophyte. And but this person, Nigel, was really wonderful. And there was one shop in town. Now Prague has turned into this wine capital in a lot of ways of Europe, but or in terms of natural wine and a new movement. But... there was one little French store that imported French wine, Italian wine, and products from around Europe. And we would buy things there and buy bottles of wine, and we would make dinner at his house and friend's house. And it's a really friendly city to be in.
How long were you there?
About 9 months.
So then what happens?
Came back to New York. And that
as an experienced as cook,
exactly, and
exactly.
I started working in restaurants again. Actually, met some people who were doing music and got into bands and took classes again. I actually took some classes in wine. Got my sommelier certificate. Took some classes at the International Wine Institute. And got a job as a manager of a very small French restaurant, and took over my first wine list. And I think it was 1999 or 2000.
The restaurant was in
New York City.
New York?
Yeah,
it still
was,
around.
It's still around. It's on the Upper West Side too, by Columbia. It was called Le Monde, and it was fun because I think I took the wine list to a place that they weren't expecting. And at the time, there wasn't a lot of wine directors in restaurants that were relatively simple. And
so that's an interesting juncture, because you go to a place uptown, not a sophisticated wine place. Do you take risks? Are you kind of winging it because you know a little but not everything? Are you trying things?
Yeah.
I mean, did you have the vision or a little of everything?
The owners were warm and... very, very supportive. I still know them to this day. In some ways, they were mentors in the industry. Simon Oren and Isaac Kesterberg, they still own lots of restaurants. And they have a certain style of French restaurant that they've been doing for a long time, which is really just meant to be sort of a simple bistro. And it's something that they like, and they have a lot of experience.
Executed well?
It's... at the time, yes.
Okay.
And now New York City has become such a vast mecca of good restaurants that even the simplest of restaurants has become much, much more sophisticated, and that's wine list included. I mean, there's still a long way to go, but to compare that time to this time doesn't make sense. But yes, they allowed me to do what I wanted, but I was still very inexperienced. And when you're in your early 20s, you think you know it all. So
right.
I was putting together things that I thought was working, and I actually met a person who was working for Kermit Lynch and who's still in the industry to this day. And
if you were just stuck with Kermit Lynch's list,
It wouldn't be bad, right. But he really turned me around, and I met a person, Marcel LaPierre.
Kermit Lynch is a terrific wine importer that, you know, finds great wineries and brings them to the States, just so our listeners know.
Yeah, and I met Peter Hoffman from Savoy at the time, and I was really impressed with he had a very small list, and it was primarily wines that were, there was no natural wine movement at the time, but there were wines that could fall into that category now, sort of ahead of its time.
Like the first curated list you saw, like there was thought to.
I had been to nice restaurants and had been to Le Bernardin and been to where there was these extensive wine lists that were very daunting. But it was these smaller lists that I had seen at, say, Blue Hill, Savoy, Flair de Sel. I'm remembering the restaurants at that time that really influenced me, and some people who weren't big wigs in the industry yet, but that were really interesting, and they were young, and they were fun, and they were alternative, and they really did have an effect on me. And I went from liking a certain style of heavy extracted wine to instantly looking at these delicate, feminine, beautiful, fresh wines that were, in a sense, I guess, the first natural wines that we were having in New York. And one of them was Marcel LaPierre's Morgon from Beaujolais, which blew my mind at the time.
Well, we'll talk about natural wines a little later on, but get us to current. So where did things move along to?
There was a... One of the owners of this restaurant I was working at was opening up a little bit more ambitious restaurant for his time. It's still open. It's called Marseille down in the Theater District.
Right.
And he had sought after a young chef who was, in a sense, the CDC of Blue Hill. And Blue Hill was
What's a CDC?
A chef de cuisine.
Chef de cuisine.
Obviously, Blue Hill was Dan Barber.
Right.
Alex Arena was his name. He was very talented and written about, but he hadn't really made any claim to fame yet, other than being a young person who was working at one of the best restaurants in New York City. And Blue Hill was, if people remember, was at that time, was that and 71 Clinton were the most important restaurants, small restaurants.
Were they credited with the first real farm-to-table natural ingredients?
Yeah, it was. I remember being at Blue Hill back then, and at 7:30 at night on some weekday, and watching a farmer walk through the middle of the dining room with muddy boots, carrying plastic crates of vegetables, and people knowing or the staff knowing the person's name. I actually remember who it was, but I just thought it was the coolest thing that I'd ever seen.
Yeah. And now it's commonplace.
The
Union Square Green Market, it's like a mecca for chefs.
There's so many ways you don't have a farmer having to make his deliveries all day long and just ending up at the last place on the list. But when I'd heard about Alex being at this restaurant, I instantly said, look, I want to do the wine program for it. I want to do something ambitious. I think that we could do a really beautiful Provençal list that focused on island, including Corsica and Sicily, Sardinia, and coastal wines that maybe had been really been focused on before in a list in New York City, and something that was still small, that was still under 200 selections. And they, again, were very supportive and said, absolutely. And when we did the wine list, Wine Spectator did a little interview with me, talked mostly
about... What year was this?
This was in 2002.
Okay. Almost 15 years ago.
Yeah, and... they were... It kind of led to what my interests were going to be.
It defined things for you.
Yeah, and then I worked for them. They sent me to Europe on an... I would say at the time it was an extensive trip. It's very hard to take off 3 to 4 weeks.
Sure.
When you are running a program. And they sent me to France. I visited a ton of properties, traveled. I actually brought a friend with me. It was during one of our nights of drinking tons of wine in some place in Avignon. I can't remember the name of it. They had just had a great wine list, and it was the first time that I'd ever really had the time to go to lots of restaurants and drink lots of older wine and really explore and be on my own. And it was defining, where I didn't have an agenda. I just was having fun and learning.
Nice.
And it was there that I came up with the first idea for doing my first restaurant, which was Moss Farmhouse. And my friend said, why don't you do a restaurant when you get back? And I said, I don't have the money. There'll never be that amount of money. He said, well, why don't we just come up with a couple ideas? And we actually spent a few nights just writing it out in a notebook and coming up with the name, coming up with some just basic ideas. And when I got back, I just started to put a lot of energy into it, and it took its own momentum.
So Moss opened up what year?
In 2004, April.
Right. So that 10, 11, 12 years ago.
And
you were there how long?
I was there until 2008. And
pretty good run, right? Very critically acclaimed.
It was
the chef.
Terrific.
Interesting wine program.
Yes. And I did the wine program. I helped put together the team and the chef and the design. And it was very naive. And at the time, I think that the time was kind to us of doing something so naive, because we didn't have anyone in the team that had done it before.
Lucky break.
Yeah.
Good for you.
It was terrific.
All right, so in the next few minutes, get me up to current time. So Moss was a great experience, because I think it was considered, you know, one of the new great restaurants when it came out. What happened after that?
I was bought out, and it gave me the money to take time off, and well over a year. And I did some sort of high-end catering for some architects, some designers, I did some cooking on my own, and I brought some people in that I had worked with in the past, and curated some wine lists. Consulted with some people. But I was also very interested in music, and I used...
You're a musician?
Yes. I play guitar, play bass, and sing.
Front any bands?
I fronted two bands.
That's why I called you a rock star, because legitimately you're a rock star,
yeah,
right?
Well, that's a little kind.
Today you're just Hugh the Wine Guy Roberta.
Exactly.
But, you know, we could reminisce a little.
So I use that time
so
to
in
kind
that,
of
in that period
high
of time,
in the sky searching.
You did the music thing.
Yeah.
That comes to an end, and what happens?
Well, it didn't come to an
Not
end.
To
I kept
an end,
doing, yeah, I was doing
on.
It. I my girlfriend and I at the time we traveled, we did the music, we recorded, we went and lived on my brother's farm, helped him get started on a organic farm in upstate New York. And I had been friendly with Andrew Tarlow and that whole group. And
You got into the Brooklyn restaurant scene.
And it was in some ways, it was kind of a respite, kind of coming out of fine dining to go to Brooklyn. And it wasn't undercover or incognito. It was really fun. And it was, again, I've been very lucky to work with some of the best people and really warm, generous people. And I was eventually the bar manager of Marlow and Sons and Diner. And I did that for a number of years. One, because it was incredibly fun, and I've met some of my closest friends in that environment. And also because I was still, in a sense, pursuing doing art and music. And as you get older and these things slip away from you, the reality of life and making a living and security do come back. And I left working for Tarlo, I can't even recall what year it is, but just about a year before opening my last restaurant, which didn't do as well as Moss, but Low Life and...
On the Lower East Side.
On the Lower East Side. I'm still very, very proud of it, but the industry has changed a lot since 2004, and Naive doesn't fly as well in the economy we live in right now.
Of course. So Low Life comes and goes. You're resilient. You're here now. Where were you between Low Life and here?
Just taking some time off seeing family.
Okay.
And really close friend of mine works at Blanca, and she had mentioned it to Carlo, and he wrote me an email. And I came in and listened to what they had to say and what they
Carlo
were looking
is
for.
Carlo is the chef of Roberta's and Blanco. Very highly regarded chef.
And
so you got here, what, about 3 months ago?
A little less than 3 months, about 2.5 months ago. And they were, again, open to my own ideas and
give you the leeway to
exactly.
Take a look at the program. All right, so we're going to get into that, but I need you, because I promised in the intro, to drop a little knowledge and help my listeners
absolutely
with what they should drink with pizza, okay? Roberta's is very pizza-centric, you know, considered one of the best pizza places in New York, Brooklyn, the whole country. So I think people realize pizza and wine is a good combination, but sometimes they don't know what to drink with it. So I'm going to throw you a bunch of types of pizzas, and then we'll try to tie it all together. And hopefully you can help me with this. So the classic pizza is sort of a margarita mm-hmm. pizza. What's probably more people eat margaritas than anything. What's a good wine to go with that?
Well, I like sparkling wine with pizza. It might not sound the typical pairing, but...
Are we talking Lambrusco?
I'm talking Lambrusco. I'm talking a sparkling Petnat. I'm talking champagne. I'm talking
Petnat
Cremant.
Is from where?
A Petulant Natural. It's a type of simply fermented, sparkling, light, natural wine.
Got it. And why do sparkling wines work with a classic margarita pizza?
Because they have good acidity. They're not overwhelming on the palate. They have enough structure and kind of bite to get through something like a margarita pizza, but not overwhelm it, and the pizza not overwhelm it. But it's I find it to be something that's refreshing and at the same time a palate cleanser as much as it is complementary to eating what is essentially bread, cheese, and tomato. And
with some acidity.
And
would you say that the toppings on pizza will obviously dictate what wines?
Of course.
So the next pizza would be a pizza with meat on it, pepperoni or sausage. What would you do with that?
Well, I think once you get into stronger flavors, things that are cured meats or prepared meats in any way, depending on the strength of them or the fat content, you're moving into, again, I look for things that have acidity. But what
like?
You Well, I was going to say something Grenache-based, Senseau-based, something like...
Rhone varietals.
Rhone varietals.
Very
are really
heavy, deep wines from France.
Yeah, and but ones that are that do have a sense of acidity and minerality. But when you're looking at the toppings, you're looking at normally what would you eat with sausage?
Right. So that's one thing. A thing that you're seeing a lot now are clam pies.
Yeah, I love them.
So what would you pair with a clam pie, which is basically white shellfish? Is there cheese on a clam pie?
There can be.
Probably sprinkled, not mozzarella, really. So what would you pair with that?
I would choose the same things you would pair with sautéed or steamed clams and butter, and that would be a white that had some depth, some a wine that does go well with seafood. An Albarino would be
from Spain,
Galicia. Would be a wonderful compliment. A rosé from Provence would also be perfectly
good choice.
Adept.
What about a spicy pie, like Roberta's Beast thing, which has soubrette and it has honey? Now, I realize it has the cheese and the meat, but it's a little spicier. Same thing, or does that warrant a different...
You can go in two different directions. I say a Chenin Blanc is always really nice with something like that. One, because it's going to be cool and clean and will have honey-like flavors and will be complementary in terms of like maybe a hint of sweetness, but of fatness to it and weight. So that it could hold up to that kind of really strong flavors. And I think that would be a really fun...
So Chenin Blanc.
Chenin Blanc. Like
from France.
Yeah, from the Loire.
Yeah.
A Vouvray, even a sparkling Vouvray.
Nice.
Yeah.
What about when you start adding salad ingredients, like an arugula with prosciutto?
I think, again... Two suggestions. One would be if it was from Italy, maybe something from the Veneto, like a Garganega, like a Suave, has some bracing acidity, some really
so would
minerality.
Acidity.
Yeah. And then Sauvignon Blanc from the Loire Valley is also a nice complement with. If you have greens and there is even a hint of vinegar and oil on it.
Okay, now two more. What about your regular pizzeria pizza or slice? Now, I realize we said margarita, but these are a little oilier and floppier and cheesier. And I think most people probably eat more of those. What would you pair with that?
Honestly, if I was going to be honest, I'd say beer is definitely...
Nothing wrong with that.
Is
so beer and just the regular pizzeria pizza.
Yeah,
I think beer is the best I'm compliment. Getting up out of my seat and I'm twisting your arm and you have to give me one wine. What is it?
I would say a light red. A Dolcetto. A Beaujolais.
We're going to taste the Dolcetto.
Excellent.
So we'll see how that goes.
A red with that still had wasn't too extracted. That was you could serve a little bit cool. That was still refreshing.
What about? Here's the last one. Anchovies, and or garlic. A lot of anchovy pizzas have garlic. Some people just get garlic pizza. Those are very sharp ingredients.
Well, I probably go back to my first, which was sparkling, because it really just has the bracing quality that could cut through things that were oily and very, very strong.
Strong.
But then again, it would be a more powerful white wine, I think, would really...
Like?
Even something from White Burgundy, a Chablis.
Nice. So I'm a huge proponent of sparkling wines, champagne. I think they're underrated. I don't think people think to pair food. So it's nice to hear you recommend it, and it's nice to hear you recommend it with pizza, whether it's a sparkler, champagne, and some of the others. All right, so I'm going to grade you on that. I'm going to give you an A+. I think you got that right. So thank you, and I hope you know people realize that when they're eating one of these pizzas, that there's a lot of different choices, and the choices vary by pizza. All right, so I want you to talk to me about the wine program at Roberta's. I know it's a predominantly French, Italian, U.S., and then there's a big mixture of world wines. You've come in to take over the wine program. Tell me a little about that.
Well, I think most people would be surprised at how extensive the wine list is. One, because when you're coming into a pizzeria, and also one that is as irreverent as this Bushwick industry place is, it can be a little daunting, but it's also a little refreshing. I am looking at the list from the perspective of making it accessible and fun, but without losing its scope. There's definitely a European focus, Italian and French, as you said, and because there's such an international crowd that have been coming in here recently over the past years, they do want to have domestic wines.
Right.
And
price point, is that a consideration?
Because price point is always a consideration.
The dinner tab isn't necessarily huge, and there's more things on the menu at Roberta's than just pizza. There's porchetta and some other inventive dishes.
Yeah, the back kitchen is something that people should not forget about. I think that so much effort and so much thought and care that goes into what's coming out of the back kitchen, that really helps justify the breadth of the
right.
of the wine list.
So you're in the process of redesigning and taking all that into consideration.
Yeah, and it's a it can be a frenetic space, and it can be dark, and it can be loud. And I think that a wine list needs to be easily you should be able to easily navigate through it in a busy environment. And for me, it's just simplifying the layout, and so that anyone from an expert to somebody who doesn't know anything can easily flip the pages and read it without having to delve too deeply in it, because it's not a quiet clinking glass right. type of place.
We have to take a break, but I want to come back, finish up the wine list. You know, I want to ask you, when people look at it, they shouldn't be intimidated. How can you help them? I want to talk to you quickly about natural wines, then hit you with my wine list. And then while I have you here, we're going to taste our weekly wine sip, which is a Dolcetto d'Alba that Hugh had mentioned. So let's take a quick break. You're listening to The Grape Nation on the Heritage Radio Network.
Music for this commercial break is brought to you by Teeth People, and this track is called French Entrance.
This is Chris Howell from Cane Vineyard and Winery, calling in from Spring Mountain above the Napa Valley. Thank you for listening to this show. In our industrial world of highly processed food and wine, we support the values of Heritage Radio Network. All of us at Cane encourage you to seek out individuality and beauty in everything you eat and drink. To learn more about us, go to cane5.com.
Spitting on my snow cone like a sick kid. This restlessness is really eating me.
All right, we're back with our guest, Hugh Crickmore, wine director of Roberta's Pizza in Brooklyn and Blanca Restaurant, which is a tasting menu. I wanted to finish up with Hugh about his tenure here at Roberta's. I wanted to ask you what I always ask people in the wine business. When the average guy walks into wine business in the restaurant, walks into a restaurant, doesn't know that much about wine, and Roberta's kind of goes both ways. It's unassuming, but it's, you know, pretty funky and could be intimidating. Then you get handed the wine list. It's an extensive wine list. What's your best advice to sort of the neophyte, the average guy that, you know, is willing to spend a few bucks on a bottle of wine but has no clue? How do you calm him down and get the right bottle in his hand?
Well, I feel that most people can be intimidated, A, by the wine list, and B, by the reality of actually talking to the person. And they should not. That we are there to help them, and I don't have an agenda. I really enjoy talking to people. It's the highlight of my evening when I get to make a connection with a table. If there isn't a wine person in the place, I think the best is to look at what the strength of the wine list is, what regions are really focusing on, and in some ways there's is one asking the staff what their favorite things are on the menu, and sometimes it's worth just taking a risk.
So don't be afraid to be a little inquisitive. But also eyeball the thing and take a shot.
Yeah,
you know, go within your price range, like you said. If you go into an Italian restaurant and it's very Italian-centric, that's their wheelhouse. Obviously, you're going to go with an Italian wine. Pick something. So don't overthink it.
You shouldn't. It's about having fun.
All right. That's fair enough. All right, one other thing I wanted to talk to you about. I wanted to talk to you about natural wines. I know it's an interest of yours, and I know you're somewhat of an evangelist of natural wines. I think we'll probably see some of them on the new list, and you're leaning towards that. Tell us, that's a title. What is a natural wine?
Well, a natural wine can be elusive in some ways because there is no official definition or designation. Meaning from any agricultural or government standpoint. But natural wine, I think, can be agreed is that it is a wine that at its very least is organic and biodynamic, and that is bottled with the least amount of intervention possible. And that means that there's no additives, that the yeasts that have been are used are only existent in the vineyard, that no
indigenous.
No commercial yeast. It's not filtered or fined. All the farming should be done by hand. And bottled, some people will say, should contain little to no sulfur whatsoever. And sulfur is a type of preservative that comes in many forms, that exists in many forms in
the wine industry.
It's a preservative. That's right. Basically, it's existed for a very long time.
So natural wines have minimal or no sulfur?
Minimal or no sulfur.
Okay.
I would say that's, at its basic definition, what it is. And it sounds like something simple, but it's a very difficult process to make something that is well made from.
It's also better for the land.
Absolutely.
There's less intervention, like you said. Now, obviously, there's a lot of quality natural winemakers pretty much in every region around the world.
Absolutely.
Is there anybody that's really leading the way or, you know, waving the flag?
Well, the zeitgeist keeps moving. In a lot of ways, it began in France and Beaujolais and quickly to the Loire Valley.
Those places were first and more extensive, you're saying?
Yes. But the reasons for some of these are really the rules and guidelines that are governing how wine is made and labeled. When you have a region where there's a lot of strict guidelines on how a wine is labeled and made, and the government is involved in it, you're going to have less movement towards, say, rebelling against that, especially if you can garner a really high price. So there's been regions that have been left the center, in a sense, like the Auvergne, which is in central France, which is probably the highest concentration of natural winemakers in France and organic farms. But it's quickly moved to Sicily, the Sierra Nevadas in the United States, the Pacific Northwest. And I would say one exciting region is or country is the Czech Republic has really, really taken off.
So can you differentiate a well-made natural wine and a well-made regular wine? I mean, it's unfiltered, probably unfined, so visibly. Taste, is there any characteristic taste-wise?
Yes. I find that natural wines that are well-made, and obviously there's different levels, just like you can have a very simple Pinot Noir, and you can have this very, very expensive Grand Cru Burgundy. The same thing exists in natural wine, but I think that a very well-made natural wine shows its place, that it's fresh, alive, it's delicious, it should taste good. Wine shouldn't taste bad.
It sounds great.
And yeah.
So if you have a good wine store, they probably will carry some natural wine.
Absolutely.
The best thing is to talk to your wine guy and say, listen, I'm interested in trying some natural wines. You could say France, Italy, U.S., whatever. And there's enough selection for somebody to look at.
Oh, in New York, there are so many great wine shops now.
Yeah, I mean, there are a few natural-only wine stores. But leave that to New York. All right, so keep in mind that the natural movement has been in wine for a while. And as Hugh said, they're making some great wines, and there's a distinction with those wines. All right, Hugh, we have a thing every week called the wine list. It's a bunch of questions. I'm going to shoot them at you. I want you to answer them quickly because I think people are interested in what guys like you who are experts are drinking. All right, so what wine are you drinking now? What's interesting you? What's on the table?
Nebbiolo.
Okay, Italian. Cheap, expensive, both?
All.
Okay.
Everything from just basic Nebbiolo to Barolo.
So Nebbiolo is a grape from the Piedmont region?
The Piedmont region.
Barolos, Barbarescos, or?
Exactly. Okay. It's something that has been outside of my realm of expertise because I've really focused on France. And
so you're starting to consume more.
And it's to really understand a different region, I really will delve into it, and it'll just be something that I will give a lot of attention to.
All right. Favorite wine and food pairing? We talked about pizza and wine, not a bad pairing, but, you know, if you could be at your place and happy and had the right dish and wine in front of you, what's your pairing?
It would be champagne and roast chicken.
Good one. You're the first roast chicken guy. Favorite wine restaurant or wine bar in New York? Who's doing it right, impressive, the right people?
Well, if it's Brooklyn, I would have to say without a hesitation, it's the Four Horsemen. I love it.
We're going to have Justin Guerin on, the wine guy there, in a few weeks. You know, that's an interesting thing, but we'll get to that. So the Four Horsemen is a wine-centric, chef-driven wine bar. It's owned by one of the owners is James Murphy from LCD Sound System. So that's an interesting place. Favorite all-time wine?
That would be... That's hard. That's like naming your favorite band of all time.
Okay, Hendrix. Go ahead.
I wouldn't want to sound...
Give me one of your...
One of mine.
Yeah.
Comte de Vogue, Bon Mar, which is a Chambon Mousin Ye Grand Cru.
A Burgundy.
Yeah.
Okay. Hoity-toity. I like that. Can you recall favorite wine label? Is there a label you've seen that you said, whoa, that's cool?
I'm really partial to the wine labels from La Clarine Farm, which is in...
Spell it.
It's L-A, like right. La, and right. Clarine, C-L-A-R-I-N-E, and it's from the Sierra foothills in California. And the wine label is designed by Jad Fair, who was one of the lead people in kind of a punk, post-punk band called Half Japanese. And the wines are fantastic.
The wines are fantastic. Yeah. Great. All right, last question. Best wine for under $15, red and white, retail. Buddy calls you up and says, you know, I'm going over to dinner. I don't have a lot of money. I want to give him an oh, wow wine. What am I grabbing?
I think you're always going to be in a good spot with Cote de Rhones are always well-priced. Under $12, you can easily find an organically made, very pretty... And
that's your red, right?
I would say that's your red and possibly your white as well. But
great suggestion. How about a white?
In white, I would be looking at Northern Italy, especially the Veneto.
Is that Orvieto?
I could do Orvieto. You can do... Suave.
And those are value priced.
They really can be really well priced. Also, whites from the Loire Valley, usually not named after the village or region they're from. They might be named after the variety, but there's so many terrific producers. People like Tir Puzzolot, for instance, that have wines that are just going to be about $12, and it'll just be great.
So there are some good choices. Yeah. Great. All right. Hugh, our last segment is, and I want you to stay here and taste with me, it's called our weekly wine sip. Every week we taste a different wine on air. We tell people last week what we're going to be drinking this week, so maybe they can go out, buy it, taste with us. Wishful thinking, but what the hell. For this week's weekly wine sip, we're going to ask Hugh Crickmore, wine director of Blanc and Roberta's, to stay with us and taste the 2014 Viette Dolcetto de Alba. Viette is V-I-E-T-T-I, Tre Vigna. Let me tell you a little about the wine, and then Hugh and I will dip into it. And Hugh, you could jump in any point. The Viette Dolcetto de Alba Tre Vigna is 100% Dolcetto de Alba grape, which is not the Nebbiolo that you find in Barolo. So it's a little different. It's from the Piedmont section of Italy, which I just said is famous for Barolos and Barbarescos. Vietti is a long-standing family winery with a good reputation, making superior wines. And they were one of the early exporters of Piedmont wines to the U.S. They were also one of the first wineries to do single vineyard designations. The wine we're going to be drinking, once again, the 2014 Viette Dolcetto de Alba, Tre Vigna, retails for about $15 to $20. It's widely available, and that makes it a good value. So we have it right here. Excuse me for reaching. Hugh and I'm going to pour it. I'm going to pour a glass for Pierre, our engineer, and we are going to talk about this wine on the air. Here you go, Hugh. Drop it.
Thank you.
Sorry for moving away from the mic. Pierre, your glass is sitting here waiting for you, and I will pour my glass. All right, so let's talk about this wine by sight first. deep, dark red, purple?
I would say it's a sort of a purple garnet.
Okay. What do we get on the nose?
It's a little herbal. Some dark fruit. But
is the herbal a good thing, or is it not a young, you know, herbaceous wine?
No, it just comes from the skins. It's
okay.
I think it's very pleasant.
Do you get some dark fruits?
I do. I get some just like bright berry.
I get a lot of.
It's very fresh.
Little raspberry, blueberry, some blackberry. All right, let's give it a swirl. Let's throw it over the tongue. Medium body?
Yeah, light to medium body.
Light to medium.
A little bit of tannin, just a little bit of grip to it.
Which is good for food, right?
A little acidity.
Good for food again.
And some nice length and minerality to it. The fruit is, it's not a big fruity wine. It's a little feminine.
What, good balance?
I think it's lovely, actually.
So, for $15 to $20, good wine?
Terrific.
Okay. Good maker, right? You agree Vietti's a good guy?
I love Vietti, yeah.
And let's talk about food again. What would you put this next to comfortably?
This you can definitely do with a simple pizza, maybe with some meats like prosciutto or speck, some mushroom, I think would be terrific. A basic margarita would be just great.
So a good pizza wine.
And also some of the heavier pasta dishes would be great.
Pasta tomato and some meat thrown in there.
Peachy pomodoro. It might even be great with the orchietti. I think this is, it's nice. I wouldn't do this with anything really, really heavy dishes, but
no,
in those
like
first
you said,
courses.
Pizza, yeah. Some pastas, some meats and all that. All right, so that's the Vietti Dolcetto d'Alba Tre Vigne 2014. Look for it at your wine store. And finally, I just want to remind you to check your local and favorite wine stores for weekly wine tastings. Many stores feature regional and thematic tastings with multiple wines. You may have an opportunity to meet a winemaker or the distributors and learn more about those wines. And most of these tastings are free, so what do you have to lose? If you have an event happening or any questions, hit me up at sam@thegrapenation.com. That's sam@thegrapenation.com. We'll get back to you with any info. We'll talk about your events. Thank you to our guest, Hugh Crookmore, wine director of Blanc and Roberta's Pizza. He's here, right in Bushwick, Brooklyn, getting things going here. Thank you to everyone at the Heritage Radio Network. And thanks again to our engineer, Pierre. See you next week.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.